just reminded, when I was a bit younger, I used to attend meetings of the American Academy of Jewish Research when the president was Salo Baron. And one of the most interesting and enjoyable things of the meetings was when he would open the meeting and he would say, "This evening we're going to hear from Professor X, who will certainly enlighten us about ABC. And then we're going to hear from Professor Y, who will tell us something about QXR. And then there'd be an hour and a half in which basically Professor X would get up there and say ABC, and Professor Y would get up there and say QXR. And you'd try to figure out why in the world they needed to say anything when he had already told everybody what they were going to say."
Yeah.
So just reminded of that because Rabbi Kalman stole my introduction. So my introduction was to say, "Welcome to the Sidra of Emor," which for a change is a single Sidra with no special Haftarah. So in that case, we're going to go right into the Haftarah. And after we've looked at the Haftarah itself, then we can take a step back and try to put it into perspective. Okay, it's a very short Haftarah, not as short as last week's, but nevertheless, it's quite short. So it won't take us long to go through it. Let's remember, first of all, to place the prophet Yechezkel in his historical context. He prophesied, not only did he prophesy during the time of the Babylonian exile, but he was living in among the exiles in Babylonia. Okay. So when he talks about the temple, and when he talks about Kohanim serving in the temple, he's not talking about the temple that had already been destroyed and the Kohanim who had served it in the past, but he was talking about a temple that would be rebuilt in the future and Kohanim that would serve in it when the time came. We've looked in the past at some of the later chapters in Yechezkel, in which he actually provides physical descriptions of the temple. And we took note of the fact that his physical descriptions of the temple match neither those of the Temple of Solomon, nor those of the temple of the Second Temple, at least as we know it from the time of King Herod and the descriptions that are provided by Josephus Flavius. Therefore, there is speculation amongst the medieval exegetes that Ezekiel was describing neither of the two temples that once stood, but that he was describing a temple that has yet to be built, not what we'd call the first temple, nor even for that matter, the second temple, but actually the long anticipated third temple. Okay. Nonetheless, when he describes now the description that he'll provide of the services that are to be provided by the Kohanim and what are the regulations that the Kohanim must follow in that service, those were true of the first temple. They remained true of the second temple. And I guess if we connect the dots and we extrapolate into the future, they will remain in force during the third temple as well. But that part of it, the third temple part of it, we'll just put into a large set of brackets and set it aside for the future. Okay, so the opening verse talks about HaKohanim HaLeviim. I highlighted it because it's a relatively unusual phrase. We know that the Kohanim come from the tribe of Levi, but we know that Kohanim and Leviim technically are two different categories. Leviim served in the Mishkan and served in the temple, but their functions in the Mishkan and in the temple were not those of the Kohanim. So just what Yechezkel means when he addresses a group of people as being simultaneously Kohanim slash Leviim, we'll see that. And then he's even more restrictive when he says, not all Kohanim Leviim, but only those who are B'nai Tzadok, only those who are descended from a particular person named Tzadok. And I highlighted that too, because obviously that also requires clarification. So let's keep in mind that when we're done with the Haftarah itself, we're going to have to clarify what did he mean when he spoke about Kohanim Leviim, what are what the translation calls Levitical priests, and why is this restricted to the descendants of Tzadok? Okay, we get a hint in the opening Pasuk because it says, it describes these Kohanim Leviim as Asher Shamru et Mishmeret Mikdashi, who continued to maintain the service of the temple, or whatever the holy service was, b'taot b'nei Yisrael me'alai, even during the time that the rest of the Jewish people went astray, hema, these kohanim, yikruvu elai l'shariteni. So as you wish, as though at the same time that ordinary people were moving away from the service of God, these particular kohanim were coming closer to the service of God. And therefore, they are the ones who, when the temple is rebuilt, will be able to resume their responsibilities in terms of the sacrifices. So what we do know even now about these Kohanim Leviim B'nai Tzadok is that they were, and we assume by implication, that there were other Kohanim who went astray from the service of God. These particular Kohanim remained faithful, and therefore God is going to reward them, and when the temple is rebuilt, they will be the ones to continue to serve him. Hema Yavoel Mikdashi, they're the ones who will be present in the temple. Hema Yikruvu El Shulchani L'Sharreteni, they are the ones who, so to speak, will approach God's table to serve him. V'shamru et Mishmarti, and they are the ones who will be in charge of everything. And now come the details. V'hayan, it will come to pass, B'vo'an El Sha'arei HaChatzer HaPnimit, when they enter into the inner courtyard of the temple, Bigdei Pishtim Yilbashu, they have to wear their uniforms. And we have descriptions of their uniforms in the Torah. And the uniforms were made from linen, from pishtim. Lo ya'ale aleihem tzemer b'sharatam b'sharei hachatzer apnimit b'vayta. When they do this service in the inner courtyard of the temple, they cannot wear woolen garments, only these special linen garments. You know that mixtures of wool and linen are prohibited. They're called sha'atnez. An exception is made for sha'atnez in the uniform of the high priest of the Kohen Gadol. Okay. Pa'arei pishtim yu'al rosham, not only will they be wearing uniforms that are of linen, but even their hats. The translation calls them turbans, but I don't think that we really know exactly just what their headgear was. I guess turban is just a way of describing something that someone would put on his head that isn't, strictly speaking, a hat. Okay. Nonetheless, these linen turbans will be on their heads. Umichnishtei fishtim, linen breeches, yu'al motnehem, will be worn on their lower parts of their bodies. Lo yachgeru bayaza, and they should not gird themselves with anything that would cause them to sweat. Uvitzeitam elachatzer achitzona, when they're finished their service in the inner courtyard and they emerge to the outer courtyard, hechatzer achitzona el ha'am, the outer courtyard in which ordinary people are given access, yifshitu et bigdehem ashehem mishartim bam, then they remove their uniforms, v'nichu otam b'lishkot ha'kodesh, and they have lockers, so to speak, in the sacred chambers where they leave their uniforms. V'lavishu b'gadim acherim, and they will change into ordinary clothing. Okay. V'lo yikadishu ta'am b'vigdehem. Okay. Because if they were to continue to wear their garments when they came into contact with the people, it would be unseemly. I got to pause and tell you a great story about uniforms. Okay, the Mishnah and the Gemara tell us about the Kohanim as they served first in the Mishkan and then in the Beit HaMikdash. Kozman shebigdehem alehem kohunatam biyadam, that they could serve providing that they were properly dressed. And if they were not properly dressed, which means if they weren't wearing their special Kohen uniforms, then if they did the exact same actions, if they performed the identical functions, it was a sacrilege rather than something that was sacred. So just to give you an illustration from my own experience. Many years ago, I had the occasion to attend a conference at Oxford University. And I arrived the day before the conference in order to spend a little time in the Bodleian Library examining a particular manuscript that was of interest to me at the time. And I didn't realize that I was getting there on the evening of a holiday, so that the time that I thought that I would have to spend in the library was really cut very short. In fact, when I arrived there, I was told that I couldn't enter the library until I got a pass from the registrar. So I went to the office of the registrar of the library, and I got there as the registrar was locking the door. The workday was over. And I stopped him and I said, "Are you the registrar?" He said, "Yes." So I explained to him that I'd come all the way from New York to examine a particular manuscript and that this was the only opportunity that I would have because the following day was going to be a holiday. And is there any way that he could just simply give me the pass that I needed to get into the library? He was very accommodating. He unlocked the door, went back inside, turned the lights on. It was winter. He took off his coat. He took off his muffler. He took off his sweater. And he put on his robe. And only after he put on his robe did he take a piece of paper from his desk, stamp it, and hand it to me. He wouldn't do it unless he was wearing his robe. It made absolutely no difference to the piece of paper that the stamp was placed on it by somebody who was wearing a robe instead of the same person who a minute before was wearing his sweater and a muffler and a coat. But to him, that was his big day kahuna. That was, so to speak, his official uniform. And in order to perform an official function as a registrar, he felt that it was required of him to be properly dressed. That gave me a tremendous insight into the importance of big day kahuna. Okay, and we continue now. Now some rules that apply to the Kohanim, not only while they are performing their priestly functions, but at all times. For example, Rosham lo yigalechu. On the one hand, they're not allowed to shave their heads. Ufera lo yishalechu. On the other hand, however, they cannot allow their hair to grow wild. So if on the one hand they can't shave their heads, on the other hand, they cannot allow their hair to grow exceptionally long, what do they have to do? Now you understand the balance of the verse. Kasom yichsimu et rashehem. Even though these are unusual words, this is the only place in the entire Tanakh that these words appear. Okay, so we can understand them only from the context in which they appear. And therefore you understand why what justifies the English translation of they shall keep their hair trimmed. Because on the one hand, it can't be shaven. On the other hand, it cannot grow wild. And therefore the alternative is that it has to be neat. It has to be trimmed. Okay. V'yayin lo yishtu kol kohen b'vo'an elachatzer apnimit. And when they are on duty and they have to enter the inner courtyard, they also are prohibited from drinking wine. We continue with more laws that apply to them at all times. Al menau grushalo yikulahem lenashim. A Kohen is prohibited from marrying either a widow or a divorcee. Rather, ki im betulot mizera beit Yisrael. They may only marry women who have never been married before. But there's an exception, v'almana sher tihi almana mi kohen yikachu. But it is permissible for them to marry a widow if this woman is widowed of a kohen. And now something more. Vet ami yoro. The Kohanim are the ones who provide instruction to the people, at least in the areas of Ben Kodesh Lechol, enabling them to distinguish between sacred and profane. Ben Tameh L'Tahor, between that which is pure and that which is impure. Yodiyum, they're the ones who provide the people with this information. Okay. Just again, parenthetically. Okay. Just about every least modern Orthodox day school refers to its morning program of religious Jewish studies as Limudei Kodesh, okay? Sacred, holy studies. Most of these same schools refer to their afternoon program, if they refer to it in Hebrew, as Limudei Chol, okay? Although the correct translation of chol as the opposite of kodesh is not secular studies, but profane. And it's very interesting because no principal nor teacher whom I've ever encountered has owned up to being part of a faculty that teaches children profane studies. So whether that means that it's a bad translation or whether it means that we've got to come up with a better name for the afternoon studies program, and it shouldn't be called Limudei Chol, it should be called something else. Okay, in any event, going on, Va'ariv Hema Ya'amdu Limishpat. The Kohanim are also the ones who serve as judges to the people. B'mishpatai Yishpetuhu. And they're the ones who have to administer the law, the Torotai, the Chukotai, the teachings, the statutes, the Chol Moadai on all religious occasions, Yishmoru, they must observe them, the Et Shabtotai Yekadishu, and they also bear responsibility for maintaining the sanctity of the Sabbath days. That's a very big job, okay? And then there are some more regulations. The El Met Adam Lo Yavo L'Toma'a. They may not approach a corpse and defile themselves, with the exception again of Ki'im La'av U'La'im, parents, L'Vein U'Lavat, children, Ach U'La'achot, siblings, but even in this case, only a sibling, only a sister, Ashalo Hayata La'ish, an unmarried sister. V'acharei Taharato Shiv'at Yamim Yisperu Lo. And if in such a case, a permissible case, a Kohen comes into contact with a corpse and is defiled, then he must wait 7 days before he can be purified. Uviyom bo'el ha-kodesh la-chatzer ha-pnimit l'sharet ba-kodesh, and on the day in which he returns to work, yakriv chatato, he has to bring a sin offering. Okay. And finally, got to the last paragraph. Okay. In reward for having all of these regulations and all of these prohibitions imposed on them, what's the reward for it? The reward is Vaitalahem Lenachala, that they will receive some sort of reward. Ani Nachalatam. God says they can rely on me. Okay. They will not require any portion of the land to be distributed to them. That is, God will provide for them. Okay, and there are any manner of ways in which God provides for them, not the least of which is that they get a share of the sacrifices that are brought. Hamincha, the meal offerings, v'chatat v'ha'asham, the sin offerings, and the guilt offerings, Hema Yochalum, the Kohen, gets to take part of it home. V'chol cherem b'Yisrael lahem yihyeh. And anything else that is that things, for example, that are set aside for special purposes and aren't used, right? The Kohen gets a share in them. Moreover, v'reshit kol bikurei chol, they also get a share in the first fruits, bikurim. We're coming up to the holiday of Shavuot, to the Chagah bikurim, okay? You bring the bikurim to the temple. Who uses them? The Kohen gets them. V'chol trumat kol, mikol trumotechem lakohanim yihyeh, and they get a portion, a percentage of all of the crops that are grown. V'reshit arisotechem, and they also get the challah offering, the portion of every loaf, every loaf of bread that requires the separation of challah, the Kohen receives a portion of it. All of this is lahaniach bracha el beitecha, and all of this is so that the people who provide these things to the Kohanim will themselves enjoy the services of the Kohanim and thereby be blessed. And then it ends on a seemingly odd note. This is the end of the perek, the end of the haftarah. Kol nevela utarefa, right? Anything that died on its own or was ravaged by wild animals and died as a result of that. Min ha'of, whether we're talking about birds, or min ha'beima, whether we're talking about land animals, lo yochalu ha'kohanim, the Kohanim are prohibited from eating. It's very strange, as I said. First of all, it's like a clunker. I mean, you know, after all of these highfalutin things, right? Be pure and be dedicated, and God will serve, will take care of you. All of a sudden, just a reminder that they have to keep kosher, because basically, not only Kohanim are prohibited from nevela utrefa, nevela utrefa prohibited to all Jews. So much so, in fact, that the customary word that we use, right, to designate non-kosher food is treif. Although treif is not the only way that food can be non-kosher, right? It's somewhat become synonymous with unkosher. So why it ends on this note, we're about to find out. Because we're going to look, as we generally do, on what is the relationship between the Haftarah and the Sidra. And the connection between this week's Haftarah and the Sidra of Emor is patent. It's obvious, okay? That is to say, a goodly number of laws that are specific to Kohanim and that were revealed in the Torah, not exclusively in the Sidra of Emor, but mostly in the Sidra of Emor, are reiterated in the Haftarah that we just read. Therefore, if you look at the chart, the psukim on the right, in the right hand side, are all from the the Torah, and opposite each one in the left hand column is the corresponding pasuk in this week's Haftarah, in the sequence in which they appeared in the Haftarah. So you may recall that the very first regulation that we were told about the Kohanim, Leviim, Bnei Tzadok, and I haven't forgotten that we need to clarify those terms, was that on the one hand, they may not shave their heads, nor on the other hand, may they let their hair grow wild, but rather they should keep their hair neatly trimmed. And that corresponds exactly to a pasuk in this week's Sidra. Lo yikruchu korcha b'rosham, they shouldn't shave any part of their hair all the way down to the skin. Ufad zikanam lo yigalechu, nor should they shave the corner of their face, meaning their chins. Uviv saram lo yisrutu saratet, nor make gashes in their flesh. All of these things would appear to have been customary amongst people in the ancient Near East as signs of mourning. We were then told about the Kohanim that when they enter the inner precincts of the temple, they may not do so after having drunk wine. This too, it's shaded because it's not in the Sidra of Emor, it actually came in the Sidra of Acharei Mot last week. But it says too, Yayin v'shechar al tesh, tatau v'anecha yitach, Aaron and his sons were prohibited from drinking intoxicating beverages before entering the Ohel Moed, before entering the Mishkan. And it says there clearly, it says, Chukat olam ledoroteichem, that this is a law for all times throughout the ages. The fact that it is repeated here in the Haftarah in Yechezkel is all the proof that we need that indeed this was fulfilled and it was a law for all time and throughout the ages. The laws restricting their marriages, right? That they could not marry widows or divorcees is also a reiteration of something that appears in this week's Sidra, where it says, Isha zonava chalala lo yikachu, not to marry a woman who has been defiled by harlotry. The isha grusha me isha lo yikachu, they may not marry divorcees, right? Why? Ki kadoshu le'eloha, because they have to, they are responsible to a higher authority. Amanau grusha, widow a divorcee, chalala zona, et ela lo yikach, they are prohibited to kohanim. Rather, ki in betulam mi'amav yikach isha, just as it says in the Haftarah, ki in betulot mizera beit Yisrael. Exactly the same. Now here's the most interesting one. Even the reference to the Kohanim as being the ones responsible to provide the people with their religious education, to teach them how to distinguish between Kodesh and Chol, between Tameh and Tahor, is also in last week's Sidra. Lavdil ben HaKodesh u'ben HaChol u'ben HaTameh u'ben HaTahor u'lahorot et b'nei Yisrael. The same word lahorot that was used in the Torah is repeated here by Yechezkel, et ami yoru ben Kodesh l'Chol. Okay. The prohibitions against defiling themselves by contact with corpses is also a reiteration of prohibitions that are in this week's Sidra. Okay, the same thing. Lo yitama, that it is prohibited in general, it is prohibited for Kohanim to become impure through contact with a corpse. However, there are exceptions made, as we already stipulated. The exceptions are l'she'eiro ha'karove, love for the closest relatives. And it enumerates the same relatives. Imo laviv, his parents. Livno levito, his children, achiv, a brother, and as we read, achoto habetula krovai lav, an unmarried sister, right? Even the concluding verse, right? The one that just simply said, and be sure to keep kosher, okay? Even that is a reiteration of a pasuk in this week's Sidra, which also says, nevela utarefa, lo yochal letoma abba, they should neither eat it. Maybe the explanation is that it isn't only a prohibition against eating it, it's a prohibition even against coming into contact with it, because that too would be a reason for them to become impure. Okay, when we started out, I pointed out that there were two phrases in the opening verse that the prophet Yechezkel addressed himself not to all Kohanim, not to any Kohanim, but specifically to a group whom he called Kohanim / Leviim, and then he restricted even that to Bnei Tzadok. So let's understand, first of all, what is this reference to Kohanim Leviim? What are Levitical priests? As we said, all Kohanim are Leviim. The converse does not work. Not all Leviim are Kohanim. Leviim, as you were, if it were, is the genus. Kohanim is the species, right? But every member of that species is a member of that genus. All Kohanim are Leviim. The curious thing is that the phrase Kohanim Leviim is not unique to Yechezkel. It's used maybe a dozen times in the Torah. And the interesting thing is that all of the usages of the combined phrase Kohanim Leviim in the Torah have something in common. Let me read a couple of them before I tell you what they have in common, so that perhaps you might be able to anticipate it on your own. Here's the first reference, right, from Dvarim Yod Zayin. It says, Ki pale mincha davar la mishpat. If a ruling in a court case is baffling, okay? Bein dam ledam, whether it's, you know, criminal law, bein din ledin, whether it's civil law, bein nega lenega, whether it's religious law, okay? How do you get it resolved? We're told, v'kamtava alita, get up and go, to whom? To the place that God will choose, that is to say, to the Beit HaMikdash. And who do you approach there? Uvata el HaKohanim HaLevi'im. You should approach the Levitical priests, VeLaShofet Asher Yehiyah BaYamim Ahem, or the judge who will be at that time, VeDarashta VeYigidu Lachai Devar HaMishpat, and they will tell you, they will pronounce the verdict. Look at the next reference. Lo yihye la kohanim halevi'im kol shevet levi chelak v'nachalan Yisrael. We saw this reiterated in the Haftarah, that the kohanim levi'im, in fact the entire tribe of Levi, has no share in real estate in the land of Israel. Rather, Yishe Hashem v'nachlato yochelun, how do they maintain or sustain themselves? God provides for them. They get a share in the korbanot, and they get a share in things like the bikurim, as we read. Okay? Nachala lo yelo bekerev echav, Hashem hu nachlato kasher diberlo, and we saw that again in the Haftarah. Or, v'nigishu hakohanim b'nei Levi, and then these Levitical priests will approach. Why them? Kivam bachar Hashem Elohecha l'sharto, because they're the ones who are chosen by God to serve him. Ulvarech b'shem Hashem, they're the ones who are designated to bless the people in God's name. Va'al pihem, and according to their decision, yekol riv v'chol naga, as we already saw, right? That all matters, or they adjudicate all matters of civil law, criminal law, or religious law. And finally, Vaydaber Moshe, Vahakohanim HaLevi'im El Kol Yisrael Emor. Towards the end of Moses' life, he addresses the people, along with whom? The Levitical priests. And what do they say all together? Hasket u'shma Yisrael, gather together or be silent and pay attention. Hayom hazeh nihiyeta la'am la'shem Elohecha, on this day you have become truly a nation to the Lord your God. V'shamata b'kol Hashem Elohecha, you should obey him. V'asita et mitzvotav, and you should perform all of his commandments, asher anochi mitzavcha hayom, with which you are being commanded this day. What all of these references to Kohanim Leviim have in common, and it's shared by the additional references that I just simply didn't cite here, is that none of them refers to the things that we usually associate with Kohanim. That is to say, there's no reference here to their offering sacrifices. There's no references here to their sprinkling blood or bringing incense or bringing meal offerings on the altar. Okay? Rather, what seems to predominate amongst these references is their service in a judicial function, their service as teachers and adjudicators. Or, as we saw in the Haftarah, and that's what's enclosed here in the little box, that ami yoru ben kodesh l'chol, their function as teachers of the people and instructing them in the distinctions between the holy and the profane and between the pure and the impure. And we find the same instruction to Kohanim in the book of Malachi, which we've actually looked at before because it was a haftarah of the Sidrav Toledot. In fact, it's interesting that Malachi and Yechezkel have something in common. They have a couple of things in common. Yechezkel lived during the time of the Babylonian exile and was preparing the people for their return to the land of Israel in the Second Temple. And Malachi was the final prophet of the Jewish people, who also lived during the time of the Babylonian exile and was preparing people for the return to the land of Israel. And Malachi too addressed the Kohanim, saying, "Va'ata lechem ha-mitzvah hazot ha-kohanim." This is a specific instruction to the Kohanim. And what are the instructions to them? Go to the last verse that's entirely highlighted. Kisiftei Kohen yishmeru da'at, the lips of Kohanim guard knowledge. V'torah yevakeshu mipihu, and people will come to the Kohen in order to have him teach them Torah. Why? Ki malach Hashem tzvaotu, because the Kohen is truly a messenger or an agent of the Lord. Not an angel in the English sense, because angels in the English sense are almost without exception portrayed as being dressed in white with halos and carrying harps. We're not talking about those kind of angels. We're talking about angels in the original Greek sense of the word, angelos, which simply meant a messenger or an agent. And the Kohanim were God's agents, God's messengers, because they were the ones who were responsible for teaching people Torah. In fact, there's a very interesting Gemara. The Gemara says as follows. The Gemara tells us that Rabbi Meir, who was one of the pupils of Rabbi Akiva, right? We're now in the period of Omer, in which we observe mourning practices in memory of the fact that thousands of Rabbi Akiva's students are said to have died during this period of time. Rabbi Meir was one of the surviving students. He was one of Rabbi Akiva's top students, but he also studied with another teacher, with a teacher who was called Acher, the other one. Right? We know that his name was Elisha ben Avuya, but he was held in contempt by the rabbis, and that's why they didn't refer to him by name. They called him the other one. Okay, and the Talmud asks a rhetorical question. It says, how could Rabbi Meir study Torah from this contemptible fellow, from Acher? Did not Rabbi Bar Chana say in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, quoting the verse we just read in the book of Malachi, it says, Ki saftei chohem yishmeru da'at, v'torah yevakshu mipihu. Why do we seek Torah from the mouth of a Kohen? Ki malach Hashem tzva'otu, because he is a messenger of God, from which the sages adduce the following. And I highlighted this. Im domeh harav lemalach Hashem tzvaot. If a teacher is angelic in the sense that he is a person of fine, upstanding character, yivakshu Torah mipihu, then one may study with him. Im lav. If, however, he doesn't meet those high standards, al yivakshu Torah mipihu, then one is either advised not to, or perhaps even prohibited from studying Torah from that person. So perhaps the reason that the Kohanim were referred to by the prophet Malachi as Malachim is because they, as people who taught Torah, they were responsible to the highest authority. Now we're left with just one final piece, and that is, why does he restrict his words, his speaking to the Kohanim, to only those Kohanim who are descended from Tzadok? So first of all, we got to look back a little in the book of Yechezkel, because this is chapter 44, and it's not the first time that he makes a reference to the descendants of Tzadok. He referred to them first in chapter 40, where it says, the chamber, the lishka, that faces north, asher paneha derech hatzafon, is reserved lakohanim, for the kohanim, shomrei mishmeret hamizbeach, the ones who are who take charge of the mizbeach, of the altar. Hema, and who are these Kohanim? B'nei Tzadok. They are the descendants of Tzadok, HaKrevim mi'b'nei Levi al Hashem l'sharato, who are the only descendants of Levi who are permitted to make this approach to the altar, this approach to God, to serve him. Who was Tzadok, and why were his descendants singled out? Radak, in his commentary, provides us with the explanation. And he says that the prophet Yechezkel specified Tzadok because Tzadok was the first Kohen Gadol in the temple that Solomon built. And indeed, if we were to look in the book of Chronicles, right, we would see the following verse. Here it is. They again proclaimed Solomon, son of David, king, that the people after the temple was built, right, they kind of like renewed their allegiance to Solomon as their king. And they anointed him as ruler before the Lord. As I said, they renewed his allegiance to him. And Tzadok as high priest. So the very first Kohen to be a Kohen Gadol in the Beit HaMikdash was named Tzadok. This Tzadok, Radak tells us, was descended from one of Aaron's sons, Elazar, and specifically from Elazar's son, Pinchas, to whom God had promised a Brit Kehunat Olam, an eternal priestly covenant. Now, Elazar was not the only son of Aharon. Aaron had another son named Itamar. So Radak tells us that whereas the eternal covenant of Kehuna was granted to Elazar and his descendants, the descendants of Itamar fell, Yaridu, they fell from their priestly status. Why? Bekilalat Eli. Because of something that happened during the time of Eli. You may remember Eli was the high priest during whose home young Samuel, who the future prophet Shemuel, right, grew up. Okay, and Eli's children were deemed unfit to succeed him. So perhaps that is a point at which the distinction had to be drawn between the descendants of Elazar, all of whom remained faithful to God and performed their priestly functions rigorously, and the descendants of Itamar, now the descendants of Eli, who unfortunately didn't measure up to those standards. One last thing, and with that we're done, is that the word Tzadok is very similar to the word Tzedokim, Sadducees. So I want to make an observation. There were Tzedokim during the Second Temple period, both as Kohanim who served in the Second Temple, as well as a party, so to speak, a sect or a party amongst the rabbis who are cited in Mishnaic and Talmudic literature as being in competition with the Prushim, the Pharisees. Rabbi Ovadia of Bartonoro, one of the leading commentators on the Mishnah, identifies the Tzedokim, the Sadducees of the Second Temple, with an individual named Tzadok, but not the Tzadok who was the Kohen Gadol in the First Temple, as Radak identified him, but rather with a certain Tzadok who lived in the first century before the Common Era, that is still during the time of the Second Temple, but only shortly before it was destroyed. And he tells us, HaMakhishin Torah Sheba'al Peh, those who denied the authority of the oral law, were called Tzedokim, Sadducees, Al Shem Tzadok U'Baitos, named after an individual Tzadok and another individual Baitos, who were students of a learned and respected rabbi named Antigonos Ish Socho, and they were led astray by something they heard their teacher say, which they misunderstood. Their teacher Antigonos is quoted in Pirkei Avot as saying, here's the quotation in Hebrew, Al tihyu ka'avadim ha-mishamshim et ha-rav aminat lekabel pras. Do not be as servants who serve their master in anticipation of a reward. And what they deduced from that was, is it conceivable that a worker will toil all day and not be paid a salary? They denied the world to come. Because they said, if we're supposed to serve without anticipation of reward, then there will be no reward. If there'll be no reward, then there is no world to come. And therefore, they denied the world to come, and they denied the authority of the oral law. And according to Rabbi Ovadia of Be'er Tenoro, that is why this Second Temple sect was called Tzedokim or Sadducees. The consensus of scholarship today actually is that the Tzedokim of the Second Temple period are the B'nai Tzadok of our Haftarah. And that because the prophet Yechezkel singled out the B'nai Tzadok to be the leading priestly family in the Second Temple, they were so. And we do have historical documentation to support that. But because the descendants of Tzadok, these Tzadokim during the Second Temple, were placed in charge of the temple, they assumed prerogatives and responsibilities that were not theirs to have. And that is how they brought themselves into conflict with the Prushim, with the rabbis. Because they, in addition to maintaining correctly that they were in charge of the Beit HaMikdash, presumed to make themselves in charge of everything else as well. And that's how the conflict began. And with that, we've gone back to the beginning. We know why that the Kohanim Leviim are so called, because this addresses their peculiar or particular function as interpreters of the law. And they were singled out as the B'nai Tzadok, either in deference probably to their ancestor, who set the tone for his responsible descendants, as opposed to those Kohanim who went astray from the service of God during the First Temple period. And with that, I will have a quick look at the chatting and see what we need to say. Profane is a Christian word from the Septuagint, always a bad word, English word to use. As I said, everybody, you know, nobody's ever owned up to being part of a faculty of profane studies. But of course, that just simply raises the question. If Kodesh and Chol are supposed to be antonyms, right? Then what is the antonym for religious studies? Is it irreligious studies? We call it secular studies because somehow secular is supposed to be devoid of religion. But I ask you truly, in a modern Orthodox day school that espouses a philosophy that is called Torah u'Mada, a combination of Torah science or knowledge and worldly knowledge, is there anything that's irreligious? Is mathematics irreligious? History irreligious? Certainly not. I think we can do better than that. And I know what Rabbi Cook would have called them. I know that Rabbi Cook would have said that the morning studies are Limudei Kodesh. And he would have said that the afternoon studies are limudei, not yet kodesh. That at least was Rabbi Cook's philosophy. Okay. Unholy, as I said, we've spoken about profanity. The list of relatives of peace that falls includes She'ero. No. She'ero is a general category. Everything else is a specific. She'er is a poetic synonym for basar. Right? Ish el kol she'er bisaro. Right? We find that. Lo tikruvu legalot erva. The laws of incest and adultery speak about she'er and basar. They're poetic synonyms. They're simply like, it's like the English word flesh. When you say he's my flesh and blood, you're saying that you're kin. And the fact that the word literally means flesh and the word literally means blood, they're not understood in that sense. Okay. Yes, a little sleight of hand, the prohibition of a widow is for Kohen Gadol only. Yes, that is one of the several differences. Well, you may remember when we spoke about the prophet Yechezkel earlier on this year, I pointed out that there is a passage in the Talmud that tells us that there were rabbis who wanted to take the book of Yechezkel out of circulation precisely because there are several things in it that seem to contradict the Torah. This isn't a contradiction per se, but then on the other hand, it's not exactly what the Torah says. Okay. Much academic work on why Zadok priest. Yes, as I said, that there's a lot of work. If you look up the entry on Sadducees, what did I do? I looked up the entry on Sadducees in the Encyclopedia Judaica. Okay. College text, the sacred and the profane. Yes, profane is the opposite of sacred. As I said, the problem in terms of day schools is only that, is that you're, whether you call them general studies or secular studies, they're not the opposite of your religious studies. They're supplementary, if you wish even better than supplementary, they're complementary, but they shouldn't be given a label that implies that they're contradictory. That was my point. Okay, teaching mean if you not believe that everything good you do needs a reward, you're kept out of the world to come. If you deny the existence of the world to come, you don't get it. That you don't get it is actually a double entendre. If you deny the existence of the world to come, then obviously you haven't gotten it, but it also means that you are denied a share in it when it comes. That's not my personal opinion. That's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, very famous Mishnah that says, "Kol Yisrael Yeshlam Chelek L'Olam Haba," that all Jews have a share in the world to come. And then it goes ahead and lists all those people who have lost their share in the world to come. And somebody who denies the resurrection, who denies the existence of the world to come, doesn't get to enjoy a share in it. But then again, they would probably be greatly disappointed if they were given a share in it, because it would make their whole life's work turn out to be a sham. They probably pleased if they deny the share in the world to come, because they can continue going around saying, see, there really is no such thing. That's why they won't let me in, because if they let me in and it really is there, I'd have to change my mind. I just made all that up. And anyway, you can just take it or leave it if you wish. There we go. And we're done.
Okay. Thank you. Of course, that's what we mentioned already in the past. Shimshon for Hirsch, had insisted that all his general studies teachers all be observant, because that too was part of Torah. Unlike the philosophy at YU, for example, where they, Kabbalah Mehmi Shamro, Rav Hirsch insists in his school that the teachers of science be from people. Okay, and this morning, Marty Lakshin gave a whole shiur on She'er, Ki Im L'She'ero HaKarov Elav, the Sifra, that is Ishto, and what does that mean? But that was this morning shiur. In the class, we want to listen, very interesting, and the problems because the Torah doesn't mention that a Kohen can be metame for his wife, and whatever. That was just a 1 minute hour on this morning's shiur. Okay, thank you very much. Tomorrow morning, Shuli Mishkin continues her series. Tomorrow, she's talking The State is Born. We're doing modern day Israel. Tomorrow night, Rebecca Winter, the Parshat HaShavuot shiur. And Friday morning, my Pirkei Avot shiur at 9:30. So we look forward to seeing everybody. Everybody, we will have a good night and all the best. And thank you, Dr. Sokolow. We look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Sokolow. Fantastic shiur.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, as always.
Thank you. Thank
the triennial cycle. Yeah, Debbie, I don't know if you meant that just for me. I'm sorry, whatever, but the triennial cycle.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Rabbi Dr. Sokolow, anything on the triennial cycle that we had mentioned last week?
I know exactly where the book is on the shelf in my office. What I don't have is access. I'm going to see. I'm going to write to a couple of colleagues and see if somebody has the book at home and can, you know, can send me the copy, you know, of the at least a sample of it. As I said, I do know that from the evidence of Geniza texts that were recovered from the so-called Shami synagogue, the Palestinian right synagogue in Cairo, that they do have a list of what the 150 weekly
Torah,
their accompanying Haftarah. As I said, I just simply haven't been able to access it.
Get to it. Okay. Is there any place I can look this up?
You know, I suppose if you Google, you know, triennial cycle Haftarot, you know, Geniza, something like that. If you use Google Scholar, meaning if Google itself doesn't turn it up, try Google Scholar, and it might lead you. I don't know whether you'll be able to access, you know, the journal in which it was, you know, published, but at least you'll get something.
Okay, thank you. I'm just fascinated by the triennial cycle, not even necessarily the Haftarot. Just how did this whole thing come to be, and how did it work out? That's all.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks. Sure. Fascinating. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Laila Tov, everybody. Any other questions, comments? All right. Have a good one.